We live in a fast-paced and hectic world where it's easy to feel overwhelmed, stressed, and out of control. How do you manage all the competing pressures without losing sense of yourself? How do you stay focused enough to not only plot a path, but follow it? Welcome to Recovery Road, a show that offers inspiration, insight, and intelligence, as well as success stories from many walks of life that can show you how you can control your own destiny. Our knowledgeable and entertaining host and her guests give practical advice that you can use every day in the quest to master your life. Now, here's your host, Leah Mattinson.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm host Leah Mattinson. And first of all, thank you, everyone, for tuning in from wherever it is that you are on this beautiful planet. Just want to take a moment to say, give yourselves a pat on the back for showing up here. For those of you who can't see our wonderful video, make sure that you tune in. Thank you. Yeah, my guest is patting himself on the back. Make sure that you tune in to watch the audio version of this broadcast by either coming to masteryourlife.ca or checking out the YouTube channel, Master Your Life, Leah Mattinson. Again, that's L-E-A-H-A, because my mom had a good sense of humor. Ha, ha, ha. Mattinson, M-A-T-T-I-N-S-O-N. you want to check out what's going on in the video version. So again, thanks everyone for joining me. And most especially thanks to our wonderful esteemed guest today, Merle Morisot. Merle, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Leah. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for asking. Now, Merle has been a guest on the Master Your Life podcast a couple of years ago, but we wanted to do a little bit of an update on Merle's story. So for those of you who don't know or didn't listen into that episode, I'll give you a little bit about Merle's background. Merle is an HSE consultant, a health and safety consultant from Sherwood Park, Alberta, Canada. Merle is now 60 years old and has been medically retired since 2016. Merle has custody of his two grandchildren. And no, that's not where the story begins and ends. Even more importantly, or maybe more importantly, and why we've had him on the podcast is because he has an incredible story of overcoming a very significant health issue. And that is that in June 2016, Merle died for 14 minutes from an SCA and awoke with a permanent physical cognitive and with heart disease. Merle's ex-wife now left 1 year after that heart attack. And in spite of that, Merle's going to share his story today about how he and his grandchildren are not just surviving, but thriving. So Merle, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I want you to just kind of dial back in your story and take us back to that day in 2016 when you had your SCA. What were you doing and what was actually the event, and how was that like to be gone for 14 minutes? I will say that there's nobody else on the planet that we know of that has actually survived an SCA for that amount of time. And we'll talk a little bit more about what your specialists say about that as we get into this interview. But take us back to the day. Take us back to the day in 2016 when you had this major incident.
You know, I got to admit right now, I'm kind of taken back hearing what happened from you. Mm-hmm. It's a big difference from hearing yourself say it. You know, like it's actually acknowledgement that all this took place, which is really important to me. June of 2016, I was participating in the MS bike ride. It was a 200-kilometer bike ride to help raise money for MS. And I had a heart attack. And I remember being in the ambulance going to the University of Alberta. I sent out one of these all email text messages to everybody to let them know, apparently I had a heart attack and it was serious, but I'd be fine. You know, I just made very light of it and I hit send. That was actually the last cognitive memory that I had for 3 weeks. During the stent implant, the doctor that put the implant in said that it was a normal functioning conversation. I was polite, I was civil, I was curious, which to anybody that knows me knows that's just who I am. Mm-hmm. A week later, back home, and what I got told is that I was talking about feeling lightheaded, a little bit dizzy, things like this. But after having a valve, because the valve was So like 95% shot. So it was a significant heart attack. You know, like we got told that, yeah, things were going to take place. So I started walking up the stairs and I collapsed and I fell into the wall and damaged the wall, damaged myself. People came running up afterwards. I'm not sure the timeline because there's sort of a conversation there. The ambulance people showed up. They pronounced me dead on the scene, things like this. They seen the stent. They went ahead and they started working on reviving me. And then after about 14 minutes, they were able to stabilize my heart. They were able to get me to the U of A. The heart stopped, from what I've been told, five more times during that weekend. And that the doctors seen that had multiple amount of time, no oxygen going to my brain. And all these things took place. And during the time when I woke up, the psychologist that was there talking about putting in the implant, I signed a signature. I signed it just like I normally would. So it was normal conversation. And then 3 weeks after the first heart attack, I woke up. And like I literally looked around, and what I actually thought initially was I looked at all the machines, I felt this tremendous pressure in my chest, and I actually thought to myself, the first thought that went through my head is that we either got hit by a vehicle or I'd been shot. Mm-hmm. Something had happened in the ambulance and I wasn't aware of it. I wasn't aware that 3 weeks had passed, you know. As time went on, and I'm getting out of the hospital, everything becomes extremely blurry. Of course, all the normal rehab things are taking place. And I'm looking at all these doctors and I could see the sense of, why is this man still alive? Like mm-hmm. everybody there is obviously cheering for me, but there's still the sense of, yeah, okay, we got to keep a tight eye on this, or, you know, this guy's going to collapse again and we're going to lose him, right? And I'm at home. And all of a sudden, I have this memory. And the memory that I have was that when I died, I'd lost my only son prior to that 5 years previous. And I remember opening my eyes. The room was dark. And then all of a sudden, I seen this silver outline that was there. And as the door opened, I see my son step out. You know, he had his hair was all done up. He had this nice little shirt kind of up to here, this type of thing, and jeans on and stuff. And he ran to me and we talked and, you know, held each other. We cried, we talked. And he talked about all the things that was going on in that part of the world and talked with me. And then his last words to me were, "Dad, you promised me you'd look after my kids." Mm-hmm. To which I said, "Yes, yes, I'll look after your kids." And that's the only memory, and I, you know, it's a little bit more detailed, I guess you could say, when we spoke before than right now, but that was the only memory I have of that 3 weeks, is talking to him, knowing that he's okay, and that I gave him my word that I would look after his kids, you know, and that was huge, you know. So then you get out of this situation, and all of a sudden you find out that walking half a block is a long, long way. And prior to the heart attack, I was actually training to climb a mountain that was 26,000 feet. So half a block was a big deal. You know, like it was a huge deal to try and get there, right?
So let's talk about your grandchildren for just a minute, just to give, again, some context to the audience who maybe didn't hear the previous interview. How old were your grandchildren when you started taking care of them? Was it the 5 years prior when your son died, or was it more recent? And then what was the age of them in 2016 when you actually had this? Because we're in 2022 right now, just to give again mm-hmm. some context and frame of reference.
So he passed away in 2011. We got guardianship papers that year. And then we got parenting papers on 2014. So the kids moved in with us for 2014. So they were in kindergarten grade one, which would have put them at 5 and 6. Yeah. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, this event occurs. So Bella at this point is 7, Cashin is 8. You know, like there's a birthday coming up that's, you know, I don't remember at all that we had mm-hmm. this birthday for Cashin. It's, I don't remember that birthday. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I was there, but I don't remember anything about it. Eh? Mm-hmm. So we had that. And then at that point, like I said, with the recovery, I got told that I would be staying home for, you know, probably 6 months to a year is what they were. You know, like nobody really knew, right? It was just like,
Yeah, and again,
it was just, I mean, I had people simply say to me that they were shocked to see that I was still walking around 2 months later, 3 months later, because nobody had ever heard of anybody surviving this. And then on top of that, when I was coming out, the doctors pre-warned everybody. We don't know if you'll be able to communicate. We don't know if you'll ever walk. We don't know any, like, you need to expect the worst. It may be that he'll never open his eyes, you know? So there I am with my grandkids. And it was, you know, like this life-saving moment where I'm staring at the two of them going, oh, I made a promise to your dad, mm-hmm. you know? And that promise doesn't include lying in this bed. That promise means getting out of this bed and doing stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So it they spent a lot of time with me. They have their own memories. They say they remember coming to the hospital. They remember seeing all the devices on me, things like this. They remember those things. Bella talks about how she crawled into bed and gave me a big hug and, you know, this type of thing. And you know, like it was just all these different memories were taking place. And then on top of that, my daughter was pregnant with her second child, right? You know, so, I mean, she had gone through this process where she lost her only brother month and a half before the birth of her son, and then her first son, then her second son she's carrying, and she loses her dad for 14 minutes and everything else. And so it was very difficult, very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to invite the audience to just really contemplate that about how serious that age of children are, like the upkeep and care of children is 24/7. It's the hardest job in the world, as we know, right? Anyone who's kind of putting in an effort, it's a lot of dedication. And so when you're a grandparent that's taken on the role, there's an extra layer, I think, too, of complexity that isn't necessarily there in the traditional sort of parent-child relationship. So psychologically, there's lots of things that need tending to with grandchildren and with trauma and with loss of parents, loss of normalcy. And so this story on the surface of it seems like kind of, oh, well, you know, that doesn't sound that hard, but it's one of those things sounds easy when you say it fast. It's just like, oh, that doesn't sound like that big a deal. But it's like the layers of complexity were very, very deep and meaningful. And so again, for people who are listening, I want to encourage you to come and just take a look at the video version of this, either on the masteryourlife.ca website or on the YouTube channel. And the reason for that is because I want you to see Merle. I want you to actually see what he looks like after having this heart attack and after somebody who's been, you know, dead for 14 minutes. Because seeing the visual representation of what somebody should look like or could look like after that much trauma, I want you to be surprised. So it's just going, okay, then. And the reason for that is because I think a lot of people go through much trauma and then physiologically they give up. And mm-hmm. So again, this show is about inspiration, insight, and intelligence to help you to live a better life. So many of us are challenged and have real hardships. But part of overcoming them is seeing somebody who's already done that stuff. And so again, I want to encourage people to come and see the video version. So let's just pick up on the story again, Merle. You're in the hospital, you get discharged from the hospital, but you really never know at any moment if your heart is going to continue to work. So the complexity of the psychology of this is quite profound. I think people take for granted really their lives, you know, like we go pretty much along the span of life going, well, my heart's beating and I'm breathing on my own and things are going okay. And we don't really give a second thought at all to our health or mm-hmm. that tomorrow is going to happen. We all just assume that it is for the most part. You know, so when you've got this thing lurking, a lurker, as I'll call it, and in the Huntington's disease community, we're dealing with a lurker all the time. So this was part of the appeal of your story is I went, no, you'll totally get this, mm-hmm. That the lurking of this imminent danger of something that could take your health, take away your mental function, take away your physical capacity, take away your emotional okayness was real. And everybody was waiting for the shoe to drop. It was like your medical team's waiting for it, you know, so you're really kind of there looking pretty normal. Looking maybe even younger than you should by rights.
Thank you. I'll take that. Thank you. Yeah,
right. But then going, okay, but really underneath all this, there's this real, you know, present danger. What was it like, or what is it like to live with that?
Can you see? I remember vaguely during rehab, the doctors, I'll step back a little bit. Mm-hmm. Prior to the heart attack, I was one of those people that couldn't decide what he wanted to be. So I was actually certified in four different careers, and I was moving quite seamlessly through them. I'm not going to say I had a photographic memory, but I am going to say that I didn't forget a lot. Okay. So, I mean, like, I was able to move. So as they're listening to my mom, you know, the ex, my daughter, people talking about my curiosity, that became a real factor for them, because now when you're not prepared to understand the magnitude of the injury, then it can be just horrific. So the advice that I was given was, don't think about it. And, you know, and I kind of looked, so what do you mean? Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Think about this. You have to look after two kids. You have to walk, you have to eat, you have to shower, you have to get out of bed. Okay. You have to care for these two people. You can't drive. You know, I couldn't read. I couldn't keep focus on watching movies or shows or things like this, but it was like, focus on the stuff that you need to be able to try and do. And which included, actually, like, my daughter came over with, it was grade 1 to 6 educational toys, things I put on my computer. So I started practicing memory games. Okay, so this is going from, like I said, functioning at that level to, okay, so congratulations, you know your ABCs, okay, like to things like this, to basic math skills, to basic English skills, things like this, right? But my prior background, we did a lot of work, and one of the biggest things that we talked about is that if you have a problem, you have to acknowledge the problem. If you don't acknowledge your problem, you can't fix your problem. So my problem at that time, instead of being this huge event of I'm not him and I never will be, became much smaller, manageable pieces, because that's really how you fix problems, is that you start really small and you start building out. I didn't understand the thought behind it. I didn't understand the psychology behind it. I just knew that I knew I had to keep it really small. So, you know, like it was going from there to creating lists on my wall. Things like this, lists on my phone. I mean, like, you know, and Leah knows this, and other people that know me know this, that if I don't write you down in this, chances are I'm not going to remember you. Okay. Like it's real. I mean, people deliberately say to me, put it in your phone, show me the date.
Has that gotten better, Merle, over the span of time?
What's taken place is that it's been almost 6 years, and my memory is, I'm comfortable saying I'm okay with going back 3 years. And after that, it starts to get really faded. You know, like I got asked some questions about 2017, 18, things like this. It's a blur. It's a real blur of what's taking place. It's just like these moments of, and then of course other people say to me, yeah, but you're getting older. You're supposed to forget, to which I'm saying, you're working, you have a full-time everything. I'm not. I shouldn't be forgetting these things, but I am, eh? You know, so it's just...
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things... Make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So maybe for the audience too, can you speak to what's the connection between a cardiac arrest and your neurological function? Because a lot of people maybe don't even really realize the impact of a cardiac arrest, a heart event on your brain.
Sudden cardiac arrest is the electrical impulses in your body stop and simply says to your heart, you're not pumping blood anymore. Okay, so your heart literally goes flat. And then at that point, your heart has its own self-defense mechanisms that it tries to put itself into defibrillation, where it's rapidly pumping really, really, really hard to try and make something happen, because the heart is still trying to save your life. Mm-hmm. So it's like just going bang, 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 as compared to boom, boom, boom. But during that time, the oxygen flow going up to your brain rapidly decreases, you know, because as you're hit the ground, your body's now saying, okay, I got to keep this going. This is going, yeah, I'm not thinking so much. So it's just going to drop off, right? And with that being said, you know, the norm was that if you had been without oxygen after 5 minutes, that you were going to suffer permanent brain damage, which I have. I mean, like this interview is in the morning because I function really good in the morning. And by 3 o'clock, not so much. I mean, like anybody that knows me knows I get sent to bed. My grandkids literally go to bed. You're getting grumpy. Go to sleep. And I go to sleep, right? I don't even think about it. It's bedtime.
Yeah. So do you actually go to sleep at 3, or do you go to sleep for a rest at 3 and then get up again for a span of time in the evening?
Oh, I go to bed at 4, and I usually sleep anywhere between half an hour and 40 minutes. And it's just enough. And then I wake up and I make supper for the kids. We have a good night, things like this, you know, but you know, like, right. And if I'm going out that night, mm-hmm. I'll actually go to sleep for a couple hours just so that I can be aware, you know, people that know me well don't like the idea of me driving after 11 o'clock, you know, because it just, mm-hmm. it's a real push for me, mm-hmm. to stay up that long. So, but yeah, but the damage, the long-term damage is it's there. They talk about, like I said, being able to go ahead and control things where, like I said, I use lists, I use my phone, I use these stuff. Conversations with people, they can get very, very frustrating simply because people look at me because, like, you know, like 70% of what you hear is what you see. Mm-hmm. So they go, well, you look good. You don't remember. I'm like, I don't remember. It's very, very hard on the family because now you look at the conditioning that I kind of left them in. 99% of all the stuff I remembered, I made it easy for everybody, you know, and now they're going, what do you mean you don't remember?
Right. And the sensitive, the not funny part though, is that your children, your grandchildren were 7 and 8 when this happened. And in psychology, what we always said in educational, like I'm educational counselor by trade. What we always said is to make sure that whatever it is that you really want your children to learn, have it ingrained in them by the time they're about, you know, before 10, because that's when they know everything. That's how they learn everything, absorb everything. And 6 in particular. So you're absolutely spot on that your children, your grandchildren already had in mind what grandpa was capable of, right?
Oh, yeah.
So for them to go then look at you through this completely different lens would be quite a task. And it's because their little brains are wired to expect, mm-hmm. certain things, right? So again, I just want to invite people to think about that, because it's not a stranger that they're dealing with. It's somebody that's in their own home. It's different if you step into an environment where no one has any expectations of you, right? A little bit. Because you still look good though, right, Merle? So I think again, people come and look and see what Merle looks like, because as a 60-year-old, you look very youthful. And so I think that can be also, people look at people who look youthful and assume that everything is going okay under the skin. And that can lead to problems on both sides of the equation, right? You just kind of go, the expectation maybe is too high, and you don't necessarily want to tell everybody what's going on either, right? So this whole, how much do you disclose? What do you tell people?
It's how much you disclose, what is there, whether or not they're willing to take on that burden. It may be as simple as that they also lost a family member to a heart attack, mm-hmm. you know, and now they're asking a very, very simple question. How come you're still alive and my loved one is gone? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's a fair question. It's a fair question. It's nothing that I've had people break down and cry in front of me, and I like said, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say to you. I mean, you know, like it wasn't my time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You know, well, your son said your sacred path, your journey is not that. Yours is doing what your son asked you to do, and you Absolutely. Took the mantle of doing that. So let's talk again back into the situation in 2016, 2017. That's what's like migrate forward a little bit. So you were raising these two beautiful grandchildren with your wife at that time. Things weren't going that well. Were they in your relationship? What was that a result of the incident, or were things kind of offside a little bit already? So it was just kind of gaining traction and got, you know, more and more disintegrated along that time, because you ended up eventually separating. And this is important too, because when people are going through trauma, healing, this huge event, whatever it is health-wise, and somebody leaves you in the middle of that, or is not even leaves, but if they're, you can't trust them. If you can't take them to the bank, this has a horrible, it's a horrible story. And so something that is so relatable, I think, for so many people, Merle. So what do you remember? Or what's the kind of status now? What was that story?
The thing that took place is that, you know, like her and I, her oldest two, who are now in their mid 30s, okay, had made up their minds that they were not going to basically provide any support for themselves. They were going to live there for free, and one of these days they're going to move out. And both of them kind of assumed that because they were there, that they were actually in charge of the house. So they, you know, at this point they're 29, 30, this type of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And they become simply this continuous, okay, let's bring this to an end. So the relationship was going the wrong way. 5 months after the heart attack, the same two people, you know, male and female, both threatened to beat me up and kick me out of my home. This is 5 months after the heart attack. I can't drive. I'm not in work. I have no means, which was then followed up by her continuously reminding people, well, it's just the way he is. You know how he gets, you know, like me, like, oh, that's his problem. But they had a history. The two of them had a history of being very aggressive, they were very angry. And to this day, I couldn't tell you what they were angry about. So we went through this, and, you know, and she looked at me, and like I said, I don't have my license back. She simply said, I'm waiting for you to be able to drive, and we got to bring this to an end. Eh? Like, you know, she says, my poor baby boy, he was 6'4", 350 pounds, hadn't worked since he was 20, loved video games, things like this. Well, he's really upset living with you. Like, okay. Yeah, and her and her kids had all, because part of the rehab program, you know, and if there's a message here, is that part of the rehab program said we have to educate the family. Mm-hmm. You need to know. So from my exclusive family here, my daughter, my grandson showed up, my son-in-law showed up, friends showed up. The ex and her kids never attended one. Mm-hmm. They never came to a single thing. And then, of course, I'm also put on a restricted amount of money from work. And again, there was never a, well, we're going to help you out and take this pressure off. So now I'm looking at this financial pressure and burden on top of that with these two people. And it just got uglier and uglier. So I was invited to a wedding in Manitoba, my niece's wedding. And her and I talked. And like I said to her, I said, I can't continue living with your son and your daughter. This is not. Mm-hmm. And literally when I was in Winnipeg, she sent me a text message to let me know that she was moving out. So when I came back, Cashin and Bella had been moved between four or five different people to kind of look after them on day, because nobody knew what she was doing. All of a sudden, she just moved out. Oh, you can look after the kids. Last time I checked, it's called abandonment, but, you know, she has her other story, right? Mm-hmm. But the horrible thing, I don't know if it's horrible is the right word, but when she left, it was like I got out of jail. I didn't have these two, I mean, very big, aggressive, mean human beings telling me how stupid I was, how I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that, that I, you know, I'd never be able to function properly. They were never there. The ugliness with them, mad at the kids, things like this, you know, like even kicking out the dog, like just, but they were gone. It was just like this sense of like, oh my God, I'm out of jail. like I'm out of jail. Like it was, there was never a night where I sat there and cried one night, you know, listened to Keith Urban songs thinking, oh, baby, 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 come back. That never happened. that never took place. It was just relief. And even with the kids, like they were upset, they were crying, things like this, but you could just see in their faces, wait a second, we can have friends over now. Because like I said, her boy was so angry that her friends were scared to come over because they look at this, really, I mean, if you're just 6 years old and you're looking at a 300 pound plus individual looking like chill, like he's going to hurt you, you don't go over to visit. So all of a sudden friends start showing up, things like this. Like it was just this, it was the environment changed. And coincidentally, all my medical things that were going on, they all started to improve. My doctor's seeing this, the cardiologist seeing this, the neurologist seeing this, people that I was working with, the social people that I was working with, the trauma therapist, everything's seeing it going up. And I've often thought to myself, what would have happened if she would have simply gone to the rehab sessions to say, this is where this is. But, you know, and I think to myself, because you look at survival rates of people that go through these things, it's not that high. You know, and I remember talking to the rehab people saying that if families would come in and understand where their loved one is at, the survival rate is higher because it's also a higher rate of recovery. You know, you're not getting the same person back. You know, I'll never be that same person. But you understand, and it makes a journey easier. You know, but the thing that was maybe her gift to me is that because she left with her kids, she took away that ugliness. Mm-hmm. And by taking that away, it was like, okay, now I can start to see things again. I can start to, you know, like I could actually sleep better. I could, all these different things, right?
Yeah.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things. Make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You're hitting on so many important things. The term loved ones. Mm-hmm. I just want people to let that soak in for a moment. Are the people who are in your life, are and do you treat people as if they are your loved ones? Or is there something else there? Because we need to check ourselves first, right? And go, okay, am I actually treating people in my life like they're my loved ones or like they're something else other than? And then how do I actually get myself in alignment to treat them properly or to assess why I'm there? And these, it has to start with us and our own self-assessment about our motivations for why we do things, like why we stick around, why we torment other people, or why we're a help. And it's really important when you're vulnerable, because it's hard to get in the shoes of somebody who's vulnerable if you've never been. Oh. It's hard to be at the mercy, understand what it's like to be at the mercy of somebody else if you've never been at the mercy of somebody else. And that's really a real term, you know. At the mercy means that without their help and assistance, or however it is that they're going to treat you, and the situation is going to be the outcome. You know, so again, it's just, I invite people to check into your own hearts first and scrub out anything that's not, you know, kind of the best and highest good for the situation. This is something that comes up so frequently. And I have it for, again, for people who are watching the video version, you'll see that I'm actually having a hard time with keeping my eyes open because there's so much of this that goes on that it hurts me. It hurts my heart this is why I moved home to help take care of my dad. So for people who regularly tune in, I just said, he is not going to be at the mercy of anyone, but somebody who absolutely adores him and will protect him, because it's so important, right?
That is a perfect lead in here because Jessica gave birth to Parker. Okay. So Parker, I've often said to my daughter, you know, like Parker brought me back because this little baby boy, he, you know, he'd look at me, she'd let me babysit him, and babysit being, I got to hold him while she went to class. Right. You know, and he would snore and smile and this type of thing. Eh? But because I had this focus and I had this feel that I had somebody who I loved and he loved me, it was just this feeling of, okay, I can do this. I can, you know, and I couldn't drive. Eh? So like, you know, the walk to there was a bit of a walk back. But I thought to myself, you know what? I promised a little boy, I'm going to walk there. So I put my stuff on, I'd walk and I'd go, you know, and he'd like look at me, big smile on his face. And even the other grandkids today, they'll go, you know, Parker's your favorite. And he goes, yeah, I might come on. You know, but I mean, but it was just having that being, you know, like, and even during rehab, I remember the lady saying, get a puppy, you know, and I just kind of looked at her and said, get a puppy. She goes, you need something that you have to. And I'm thinking, I got a Parker, there's something better than a puppy, eh? You know? And, but I mean, as all this evolved, he got to provide his positive energy, his growth, his spirit. I got to say, I'm making a commitment to see that I get to watch you grow as long as I can, you know? And it was truly just a blessing just to be with them, eh? You know, which was just, so you're absolutely right. It's like, you know, being there with the right people, the right time to do these things. So.
And also creating the right circumstances, because to your point, you know, your therapist said something about get a puppy. And so you did. So you didn't resist.
No.
Suggestions or ideas, you kind of, and even if you could, it's like if you cognitively couldn't quite get there, like how does this equal that outcome, you went with the people, you went with the suggestions that people suggested to you. So what were some of the best suggestions along the way, or things that you could share with people that were really good strategies that helped you most?
Some of the best were, okay, you know, keep a limit on that list. You know, like don't, if, you know, instead of simply saying you're going to do 50 things today, maybe 10. Well, let's go from like 5 to 10. Okay. Things like this. Create a base. It's okay. And I remember my mom, who's in her 80s now, so be saying to me, it's okay to say you don't remember.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay. That was huge. Eh? You know, and then you started looking at like books and things like this. And it was like, okay, well, maybe I have to relearn how to read. So all of a sudden I got, you know, like my granddaughter was in grade 4 at the time. She came back with a basic physics book. You know, this is how brain injury works. Okay. Like it's really strange. Okay. Like basic math. So all of a sudden what I seen from that basic math, it went back to my understanding of being a power engineer. It went back to my understanding of what it was to actually write my second year calculus exam that I passed. In my mind, I seen the paperwork, I seen everything, it all went through. If you ask me today, can I do calculus? The answer is no. But at that moment, you know, and then I start talking to people that are within the industry, because now I'm like, okay, guys, I need to understand what's taking place here. And one of the nurses that I had, and just a wonderful lady, she simply said, if you took a group of circles around and around and around, she says, there's these bridges that go. You have your core memories, who you are, things like this. Then you have all these life experiences. She says, when your arrest occurred, these bridges cut. So you don't know how to get from that point A to point B. And then you're sitting there going, and she says, but the key, and I remember her looking right at me and she took my hand, the key, if you're not supposed to learn what's in that bridge right now, that's okay. Go to the next one. Don't stay there. So all of a sudden I'm starting to learn different things that I've never done before. Eh? Like just to try and see, just to try and create pattern and knowledge. And the more that I challenged myself going right back to real basic stuff, I'm talking grade one, grade 1, 2, 3, 4, like understanding those things, understanding language, like, you know, and just how to speak and how to do math. All of a sudden other skills started to appear because foundationally I didn't have the memory recall to go from point A to point M. I only had it to go from point A to B, you know, I didn't know how to make those leaps where with automatic memory, you know, like this is, and I've told you this before, this to me is still one of the funniest things in the world. You know, I said, I know for a fact that this morning I did not wake up with you.
And how do you know that? Because you have memory recall?
Because, and what the thing is, though, is that your memory recall is that I also know the third thing you did this morning.
Which is?
You took your second step. So as she's telling her the story, we're just kind of looking at it. She goes, nobody remembers this basic stuff. Right. So I literally get out of bed going, I got to do this. I got to do this. I got to do this where I can actually get to a point where I'm trusting my automatic memory. I only go to a certain extent where I stop and go, because I get this funny feeling going through me going, you're not 100% clear on this, buddy. You know, so I dial it back and I get the supports. I get the books. I get videos. I mean, like I'll pull up YouTube stuff, things like this, and watch through and through and through to make sure that I understand it. And they're like, okay, I got it. I got it. Like, I mean, as silly as this sounds, I remember clearly trying to make a peanut butter and jam sandwich in the toaster. I had the bread. I had the peanut butter. I had the jam. I had the butter. I could not figure out how to get the toaster to work, because the toaster has to be plugged in to stay engaged. Right. I didn't know that. So I looked at it. Well, you know, I'm just going to have an untoasted peanut butter and jam sandwich. It took a long time to remember. But to this day, when I look at anything electrical, I make sure the power is on or off when I'm finished, which is really basic safety rules that we did in our industry, right?
Right.
But I couldn't remember. I remember staring at the toaster thinking, I got to buy another toaster.
Meanwhile, what's going through my mind is, as a grandmother of all these grandchildren, I go, I'm surprised you didn't put the peanut butter and jelly on the sandwich and stick it in the toaster and just leave it there.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a thought.
So at least something was there as a stop to go, hang on a minute.
Yeah, but it was sequence, right? It's just like, I thought, okay, I got to have this. How does this work? And I couldn't figure it out.
Right.
You know, and then like even like resetting the alarm, my garage door opener. I didn't know how to do that. I mean, I think I tried that for 4 hours before finally got the right video. I was like, oh,
so you were, that's pretty good. How long did it take you to actually learn how to read again? Like from the real basic, like understanding your letters, like sitting down every day, what was your frequency of doing that? Was it 10 minutes or was it more like an intuitive? You went, I'm going to study this until I get something. What was the strategy around that?
It was continuously trying, and I would actually go back a chapter, go back another chapter, things like this. Mm-hmm. I actually completed, I was very tickled, and I got the book upstairs in my bedroom. I actually completed the first book to read that was a little over 200 pages, this last spring. It took me that long to read that book because I couldn't stay there. I couldn't, like, even to this day, fictional books, I have a hard time reading because I can't kind of imagine where this is going, you know? And, you know, and one of my therapists said, yeah, it might be because right now your story's quite fictional, you know? So like, why do you want to go down another road of fiction? I'm like, that's a good point.
Love it. I love it.
So I sort of stick to things that are factual. Like, I mean, if I can read cooking books, things like this, I'll read them. If I can read something with history to it, I'll read them. But it's very slow. It's it's like I said, prior to the heart attack, I mean, easily on my mantle, I would have 6 books that I'm reading all at the same time. I could pick it up and like within a sentence, boom, I was back. I was back in the characters, back in the people. I was there. It was all stuff. Now, I mean, like I haven't read a fictional thing in easily 6 years. You know, and the books that I do celebrate going, okay, I got it. I got this. This is making sense, right? You know, like right now, strangely, and I can't explain this. I bought this book where it's about the NDP winning the last election. Okay. I'm finding it quite fascinating because somehow what's taken place is within our province, people that I can kind of know, different policies, things like this, was all this stuff that I can kind of like reach out and touch, right? And say, yeah, you know, and of course, I'm, you know, reading about Rachel Notley, going, oh my God, that lady's brilliant. You know, like, I mean, it just like, I knew she was smart. I didn't realize how smart she was. I was like, wow. I mean, like, it's really inspiring to read it, but it's real stuff, eh? Where like anything outside of that, it's very, very difficult for me to get my head wrapped around. How long I'm going to remember that? I don't know. I don't know, you know?
So some of the other things that are affected, we've got about 4 minutes left. So I just want to talk about when a person looks so normal on the outside and yet has this real challenge inside in the neurology of things, what do you think are the things that people miss, or what do you think are the things that are the most challenging for you to talk about or to feel through with other people or in your life in general? Where are the biggest challenges and where are the biggest victories maybe?
The biggest challenge is that it's very hard for people around me to understand that I physically know my memory's failing. Mm-hmm. I know that. I like my memories of things in my 20s and 30s, things like this, they're just really vague. You know, of mm-hmm. course, I had my kids when those age, and I'm thinking about stuff, you know. And as a parent, to lose memory of people you love is horrible. Mm-hmm. You know, so I embrace the fact that I was there. I was a good dad, and I know that. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm sort of like, okay, I've got my grandkids. So I'm kind of like reliving, I guess you could say, but not being, taking things away, hopefully, from my daughter, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the, one of the hardest things is that people just don't understand that, you know, like when I say to you, I don't remember, I actually mean I don't remember. And it's not a subtle, I don't remember. It's a flat, I don't remember.
Right.
It's like black and white, which really is discouraging. So that to me is difficult. I've accepted the fact that I have to repeat things that I do over and over and over again, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not automatic. It's not like I know what my third step was. It's not automatic. It's just a flat, I have mm-hmm. to do it. Mm-hmm. In terms of being prepared, I'll walk into a meeting and all of a sudden I can literally just zone out. And, you know, and I have to be really aware that if I'm going someplace that I have to be rested, I have to be there. If I'm not writing stuff down, there's a good possibility I'm going to forget. But despite all those things, the kids are having so much fun in school. They're teaching me, right? So like, you know, like I become this mm-hmm. super active grade 7, 8, you know, parent because, well, they're teaching me, you know, and I told this to the teachers. I said, you need to understand some of these questions you're getting back, they're probably coming from me. Right.
Yes.
You know, right. I said, you guys are teaching me how these things are taking place. Like, mm-hmm. you know, what is happening with schools, with puberty, with all these things, with teen years. I mean, it's been a little while since I've been a teenager, you know, things have changed. Mm-hmm. So it's like understanding those things. Eh? So it's like this ongoing thing, but you know, like I say to everybody, I wake up, you know, I'm blessed to be here. You know, I'm okay. The kids are healthy. I get hugged every morning. The dog comes up, licks my face. He's all happy to see me. You know, I get to do my normal stuff. I mean, like it's good all the way around, eh? You know, and I've accepted the fact that this is, I hate using the term, but this is, you know, my new normal. It's not the way it was, mm-hmm. but it's still really good. It's still really good, you know, and I just got to keep on pushing forward. So yes.
I love it. It's such an encouraging story too. And there's lots of people dealing with failing. Look at me, failing brain activity, because I'm having failing brain activity myself. So it's just you go, hang on a minute. But I do have like my cues and things that are in place so that I know when to start talking and I know when to stop talking and you can still thread together a fairly reasonable conversation. What would you say, Merle, for the last parting thought for people, of the thing that has helped you the most in this last 6 years, or two, let's say three things, because I've heard a few, but what would you say are the things that have helped you the most to maintain your sense of humor, your youthfulness, and your gratitude for life?
The trauma therapist, she asked me to create basically like a mantra to myself to simply say, what are the things that you want today, you know, and things like this, right? So with that, I put myself into some breathing exercises. I kind of settle my head to make sure that my head is focused. And I simply say, you know, like I believe in love. I believe in hope. I believe in faith. I believe in kindness. And I believe in me. And at the bottom of that is the date that I died. And it's there, it's in my wall. So I take a look at it. If I lose focus, I go, wait a second, you're brought back for real good reason. You go back to these first five, you don't give up. It's real simple. You just don't give up. Keep it simple. Don't give up. You know, just keep on going.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Merle. It's been such an honor to have you on the show again as my guest, and everyone just, I'm so grateful for everyone who's tuning in. Please share this episode with those who you think could use a bit of encouragement, whether they're just straight up single human beings, people going through a tough time, people raising children or grandchildren. I think there's just so many lessons and encouraging things to think about in here. Everyone, love yourselves, love each other, mind your minds. That's all for us. Bye for now.
Thank you for being a part of our program today. Master Your Life is a presentation of Leah Mattinson Enterprises, Inc. Join us next time on Master Your Life, helping you to discover the very best of you.